When it comes to your personal health, did you know that there are more choices than you think? You need more information in order to make the best decision for you and your family. Welcome to Paradigm Shifts in Wellness and Sport with Dr. Ivan Wergo. Western medicine is always seemingly thought of as the only standard in making health decisions. When we challenge those decisions and seek alternatives, we can put ourselves on the road to better and more cost-effective treatment. Now, here is Dr. Ivan Wergo.
Thank you for tuning in to Paradigm Shifts in Wellness and Sport. Today's show, Best of 2013 Paradigm Shifts, will feature several of the more interesting discussions that we've had in 2013, and I'd like to share them with you in one package. Paradigm Shifts is about changing old thinking in health and wellness with new emerging ideas. I recommend non-pharmaceutical interventions, minimizing surgery, and creating preventative solutions first. You'll always have the option to consider drugs, surgery, or injections, but there's almost always multiple other options before those three. During each show, I'll be giving a tip of the week. This may be an answer to a question, a suggestion to improve your posture, or an exercise to help correct a muscular problem. Send me a question. You can email me at ivanh@psipt.com, and I may answer it as the tip of the week. So let's begin with this week's tip of the week, the importance of drinking filtered water. The threat of harmful contaminants in drinking water can no longer be reasonably ignored. The correlation between contaminated drinking water and many significant diseases and health problems is far too strong to discount. Of course, municipal water treatment facilities have lowered the presence of many of the more harmful contaminants, and the EPA has set maximum contaminant levels below which it is assumed that contaminants may be safely ingested into the body. Municipal treatment facilities are not infallible, and EPA levels do not represent a safety level for every person. Children, the elderly, and those individuals who have weakened immune systems are particularly at risk to drinking water contaminants. Two of the most volatile drinking water contaminants, chlorine and fluoride, are actually treatment additives. Also, lead, another of the more harmful contaminants, enters the drinking water after treatment and cannot be regulated by municipal water systems. If lead cannot be regulated in our drinking water, how can municipal water systems provide healthy, clean drinking water? It's time for a paradigm shift. In order to be sure you and your family have access to clean, wholesome water, you need to look into a water filtration system. There are many home treatment alternatives that can purify drinking water to a greater extent than city treatment plants. Reverse osmosis and distillation, two of these alternatives, are moderately successful at removing some contaminants, but they are expensive and can be wasteful. Bottled water, besides being expensive, can be unfeasible as a main drinking water source, and it's not under the same government regulations as municipal water, and may actually sometimes contain more contaminants than tap water. The absolute best technology now available for treating water and removing undesirable contaminants is water filtration. Water filters, when compared to any other water treatment alternative, will remove more contaminants and provide safer, healthier drinking water. We know that natural clean water is a human right, not a luxury. And no one should have to endure contaminated and medicated drinking water against their will, especially in the 21st century. Unfortunately, what many consider water is actually a cocktail of synthetic and organic contaminants that do not belong in there. This is due to outdated water quality laws. And these outdated water quality laws do not require water treatment plants to remove the onslaught of modern-day contaminants. As a matter of fact, the disinfection and treatment process itself introduces even more chemicals: chlorine, chloramine, fluoride, anti-corrosives, scale inhibitors, and others into the processed water. I use PureFect filters. I had their filters installed in my new home in June. PureFect's filtration systems are simple, elegant, and extremely effective at reducing the widest range of common contaminants. In our last home, I used to cringe when my children, Ivan Jr., now 3.5, and Elise, 2, would take a bath and drink their bath water. But since putting in PureFect filters for my entire home water supply, I now enjoy watching them play and drink clean, pure water. The PureFect filters remove contaminants that I didn't even know were in the water supply, including radiation, chloramine, which is ammonia and chlorine, fluoride, chloride, heavy metals, pharmaceuticals, drug residues, illegal and legal, sediment, odor, strange tastes, petrochemicals from oil industry byproducts, radioisotopes, and other volatile chemicals. Not only does the PureFect water filters remove these contaminants, but it also improves the quality of water by raising the alkaline pH, by releasing trace amounts of natural minerals, improving antioxidants, and it supports natural electrolytes, and improves redox, which lowers water's oxidation potential. On their site, they list a couple of testimonials. The first one: in my youth, I occasionally hiked along alpine meadows in Utah's Uinta Mountains, drinking pristine, snow-melt, milky-appearing water. Seldom since have I re-encountered that taste in water until now. Second testimonial: I used to enjoy spring water on my organic farm years ago. Investing in PureFect water filters was one of the top three healthiest things I did for my family in 2013. Go to my website at psipt.com under the tab Work for Us, and on the bottom of the page you'll find a link for the PureFect website. Feel free to browse through their site, which is quite informative. The Ultra Whole House system runs about $1,250, and the Ultra Under Counter for the kitchen sink runs about $340. There's nothing more basic than drinking, bathing, and cooking with pure water for improving health and wellness. Consider this for your family in 2014. And that is the tip of the week. So now let's begin with today's program: Paradigm Shifts in Health and Wellness, Best of 2013. Why is this important to you? Most Americans are dissatisfied with their current health care costs and are apprehensive about their future expenses. You may want to consider a more conservative approach, like physical therapy, before a more invasive and more expensive approach, like drugs, surgery, or injections. In the episode on November 4th, Secrets from Top PT, Robert Johnson talks about reductionism in the biomedical research and practice, and also discusses how the World Health Organization encompasses the biopsychosocial model. When we come back, we're going to look at more interesting clips from 2013, Best of Paradigm Shifts in Wellness and Sport.
I want to ask the listeners a question. Do you know what the four vital signs are? Take a moment and try to think of them. I'm sure you're able to come up with at least a couple. They are pulse, blood pressure, core temperature, and respiration. Did you know that the U.S. Congress designated 2001 to 2010 as the decade of pain control and research, and the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations now requires physicians to consider pain as the fifth vital sign? I'm going to describe our current medical model, or basically the way medicine is practiced in the United States. This model has been used since the mid-19th century. It needs an overhaul. It is called the biomedical model. Dr. Lorge Lumberg, editor-at-large for MedPage today, wrote the article, Biomedical Reductionism Falls Short. Here are 3 points from his article. The results of the application of reductionism in modern biomedical research and practice has been nothing short of miraculous, but while wondrous for some things, reductionism alone is incomplete. 2. The basic premise of reductionism is that by breaking down or reducing complex biological or medical phenomena into their many parts, one is much more likely to understand a single cause and devise a cure. 3. Most contemporary medical researchers have concluded that the chronic degenerative diseases of modern Western humans have multiple contributory causes, thus not lending themselves to the single agent or single outcome model. Bob, can you discuss the limitations of the biomedical model?
Well, I think you summarized them well with Dr. Lundberg's paper. And in essence, it's that dualism breaking. Really, if you think of it, the biomedical model really separates the body from the brain. You know, it's a Cartesian model. And everything is looked at from below the head. And so if your shoulder hurts, and the x-rays look okay, and the tests appear, the surgery appears to be normal, then the biomedical model doesn't have a way of explaining why that shoulder still hurts. Now, it's really important to recognize that the biomedical model has worked well. 80% or so of patients get better using this way of looking at the world. But there are 20% of patients that get chronic pain, chronic dysfunctions in many other ways that the biomedical model can't understand or help us better rationalize. And that would be the biggest limitation, that it, as you said in number two, that in essence, by reducing that complex biology into a single part to devise a single cure in those 20%, it isn't a singular piece.
And so, yeah, it's based on the Cartesian model, which is from the Middle Ages, when anatomy was first being introduced, as well as science as a whole was, the way of understanding things was reducing things to their least common denominator or into the smallest piece. And so our current medical model still considers some of those philosophies when making decisions.
Mostly. I think that our current philosophy, we're all trained as allied health professionals, as well as in essence as a culture, to look at a separation between my body and my mind. Even though we know inherently that they connect and interact, the way that we've been taught as a culture and as a medical culture to look at the world and assess things is that there's a separatism between the two.
And so this new model, the biopsychosocial model, tries to include the entire person. Dr. George Engel wrote the landmark article, The Clinical Application of the Biopsychosocial Model, in 1980, and many of its conclusions still ring true today. Here are a couple of points from that paper. The crippling flaw of the biomedical model is that it does not include the patient and his attributes as a person and as a human being. The biomedical model encourages bypassing the patient's verbal account by placing greater reliance on technical procedures and laboratory measurements. Bob, how does the World Health Organization and other countries in the world view the biopsychosocial model?
Well, generally, we in the United States are behind the eight ball in engaging in the usefulness of the biopsychosocial model. The World Health Organization has been encouraging many governments and policymakers to engage in this way of looking at health and function and dysfunction for a number of years, especially in a number of countries in Europe and in South America. And yet we here in the United States are kind of recalcitrant to wanting to hear that message, perhaps for a number of reasons, but it is the way that medicine is moving in many other parts of the world. The World Health Organization, the International Association for the Study of Pain, numbers of expert papers, numbers of textbooks, randomized controlled trials. There's much literature on the usefulness of looking at health and disease from a broader perspective, the biopsychosocial model, under which the biomedical model still works, but the biopsychosocial model throughout the world is much more engaging than it is here in the United States.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Explore the power of natural healing with Howard Strauss. Join us each week for an informative program that'll help you learn effective healing methods using natural remedies. Howard's guests include top researchers, authors, and experts who will share their views on a variety of natural products and healing methods that really work. Tune in to The Power of Natural Healing with Howard Strauss, Mondays at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to Paradigm Shifts in Wellness and Sport with Dr. Ivan Wergo. To connect with our program today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to ivanh@psipt.com. Now, back to Paradigm Shifts in Wellness and Sport.
On November 11th, the episode Take Back Your Back, we spoke with Dr. Chad Garvey. And he describes how the biomedical model is utilizing more and more resources, that is, spending more and more money, or costing more and more money, but getting less and less positive effects and less results. Also in that segment was a neuroeducational session, whereby just listening to this session, you're able to understand pain physiology, neuroscience, and psychosocial issues. So by listening to this segment, it can actually decrease your pain.
Well, I think in the Western medical model, it's very easy for us to look at more is better. And in fact, from a cost perspective, we lead the world in how much we spend on medical issues. The problem with that is that when it comes to chronic low back pain, it's not a simple mechanical problem, as how most people think about backs. Backs having bones and ligaments and muscles. Think about very much in a biomechanical sort of light. But with chronic low back pain, it doesn't work that way. And so in putting more medicine, more procedures, more of all of that actually has shown to not work, and in fact can make the patient worse and put the patient at greater risk for long-term issues and even short-term issues. The point of having manual physical therapy, exercise, and education really provide the most and safest bang for the buck when compared to all of those other interventions that you listed.
Let's look at another report. According to a February 2008 research study appearing in the Journal of American Medical Association, physical therapists offer low-cost solution to increasing health costs. Spinal manipulation, exercise, and advice or education offer patients an effective alternative for back pain. Health expenditures for patients with spinal conditions, including low back pain and neck pain, are rising without any associated increase in health status. The study suggests Americans may be wasting their money for treatments as the overall proportion of people with impaired function increased from 1997 to 2005, despite a 65% increase in expenditures to treat spine conditions. In the episode Dial Down to Power Up with Tai Chi, we spoke with Bob Piper, and he compared efficient breathing to that of how a baby breathes. And actually, when you watch a baby breathe, they do have very efficient breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, that is, where their lower abdominal expands and very little breath comes from their chest, which is actually shallow breathing and inefficient type of breathing. So Bob does a good job of explaining how his instructors, his Tai Chi instructors, taught him to use diaphragmatic breathing, or the Dan Ten. Bob, in your practice, has Tai Chi helped anyone with poor breathing habits?
Oh, yes, greatly. The first thing I see with a lot of corporate Americans is that they breathe very shallow because of stress. And the first thing I do, as I take them to the side, I said, let's work on your breathing before we do anything else. And within a couple classes, they see a massive change. And it's because we become unconscious of our breathing patterns. We encounter hundreds of acute stress responses at our desk, while we're driving in our car, and we forget to breathe properly. I mean, that's the first thing that we should focus on whenever we have a stress response, is to focus on your breathing, bring your attention to your breathing, rather than, collapse that. And you mentioned breathing from the diaphragm. I mean, that is an extraordinary practice. It's been used for thousands of years in China and different Eastern practices. They call it the breathe from the Danten, from the stomach. Taoist monks recognized that babies breathe from the stomach, so they copied that breathing pattern. So these Taoist monks were like scientists. The formation of traditional Chinese medicine is based off of meditation, Tai Chi, and these practices, and then they incorporated it into their healthcare system. So what you see is a science, and they were the first ones to say, okay, breathe from the stomach. That's a really incredible practice. So that's why I think that the first thing we need to do is whenever we have a stress response is to bring our awareness to our breathing. And I think massive changes in life will occur.
I agree. And I actually give that example too to my patients. If they observe a baby breathing, they automatically breathe efficiently.
Yes, yes.
Through their diaphragm. They also have lateral excursion on their lower ribs, which means that their lower rib cage opens out, coordinating with the diaphragm as you take an efficient breath.
In the episode Posture, It's Not All in Your Chair, we spoke with Kevin Dunn, physical therapist from Oklahoma City. And he describes the body's requirements to maintain good posture. If you had to distill it down to one focal point, would be muscular strength. And he also gives some suggestions on how to sleep side-lying and decreasing some of the pressure on either your hips or your shoulders.
It really doesn't give any insight on how to maintain good posture. Kevin, what are some of the body's requirements in order to maintain a good posture?
Well, interestingly enough, if you force me to boil down the primary attribute of the human body for maintaining good posture, the word that I would throw out there would be strength. And that's not something that typically comes up on people's lists of good postural attributes. In my practice, we put forth the idea that range of motion and strength go hand in hand together. And if you can envision the central nervous system almost like a marionette puppet master, constantly regulating and adjusting tension within the musculature of the human body, position or posture could be a manifest of imbalances in the tension on those strings. And what we know about the body from a muscular standpoint is that if the body loses the ability to produce tension in a particular muscle, it also has the ability to simultaneously adjust tension in the muscles that would provide additional help for whatever muscle loses its ability. So maintaining proper muscular strength or maintaining the contractile capabilities of muscles becomes critically important for maintaining good posture, because you need the muscular support in order to maintain position against the force of gravity. Something else that's kind of interesting is that you can take that idea and you can extrapolate it out much further than just the musculature around the trunk, which is kind of instantly what comes to people's mind when you start talking about muscle. Most people are aware that your core is important and so on and so forth, but we also have this other positions that we need good mechanics in, standing being one of them. And, you know, musculature of the hip and the foot becomes critically important for maintaining good standing posture for the same reasons we talked about before. If there are weaknesses in particular areas, the body's going to have to adjust or manipulate position to account for those weaknesses. So the thing that I would boil it down to, if forced to say one thing, would be maintaining muscle strength.
Kevin, do you have any suggestions for sleeping posture?
The only suggestion I have, Ivan, in addition to the things that are outlined here, one of the tricks that we use to help get people comfortable side-lying, which is my most frequently recommended position for sleep as well. One of the tricks that we use in my clinic is, you know, if you look at people standing straight on, it becomes pretty obvious that there's a disparity in width between most people's shoulders and hips. And for men, it's usually, you know, shoulders being wider than hips. And sometimes for women, it can work the other way around. But there's usually a distance, a difference in the span, tip to tip, from shoulder to shoulder, and from one hip to the other. And when you present that aspect of your body to a bed, regardless of how firm it is, your spine is gonna sag. You know, there's gonna be a bow in your back from shoulders to hips. We would call that lateral flexion or side bend in the clinic. But one of the things that can become very helpful for folks is to take a very, very thin, folded up bath towel. And the thickness of this bath towel may only end up being, an inch or two at the absolute most. It doesn't have to be something significant. But if they put that bath towel in the space between their, basically just above their pelvis, to give their side a little bit of a boost, it actually kind of helps to flatten out that curvature, which is kind of difficult to explain over the phone, but I think we've gotten pretty close. So if they get on a side for some reason, they can't get comfortable on one side or the other, they can try that towel positioned just above their pelvis, not more than an inch or two in thickness, to help kind of help balance out that curve.
David Butler, the international educator and author, had the opportunity to join us on Paradigm Shifts. And he gave his definition of what a paradigm shift is to him. But he also described how the pain of lost love and that of an acute low back pain episode look kind of similar in the brain when comparing functional MRIs. And he also talks about the chronic pain epidemic, particularly here in the United States. David, what does paradigm shift mean to you?
Paradigm shift means a lot to me, Ivan. I think in the area of pain, I'm always happy to say that in the last 10 years, we know more about how pain works and how it's made than in the 1,000 years before. And that's due to paradigm shifts. So, for example, in our understanding of pain, I think one of the key ones is the neuroplasticity paradigm shift, the awareness of how changeable and how powerful change in the brain is. There are other paradigm shifts too. We know a lot more about pathways in the brain. We know a lot more about some of the psychological processes which can lead to pain. And I probably should say another key one is we know a lot more about the biology of how we think and how we feel. I think in the last 10 years, there's been a massive paradigm shift in understanding of pain.
And I'm sure that information can help a lot of people.
That information, if taken carefully and put into appropriate educational packages, can help a lot of people. For example, we're now aware that if a person understands how they hurt and why they hurt, they can do more about it. And particularly in chronic pain, education about biology, particularly involving the brain, is far more powerful than any drug currently available. And there's no side effects, and it's available 24/7, and you don't need a prescription.
We all know that pain can be a more complex experience. The word pain is also used in relation to grief, loneliness, and alienation. What is it about the pain of lost love that can be as debilitating as any acute low back pain? David, does your brain know the difference between lost love pain and low back pain?
That's a great, great question. And it's really interesting because in some of the more recent research studies where the brain has been imaged, for example, the pain of lost love or bereavement or missing out on something in our brain, the activity pattern looks fairly similar to if you've actually done some damage to muscles or joints or nerves. So it's actually quite a lot of overlap. And I think you touch on a really important point there, Ivan, to fully understand pain. You will hear people out there talking about physical pain and emotional pain as if they were two different things. Well, they're not. In the last 15 years, with the thousands of brain maps and scans that have been done, when we look at a brain in someone who says they are in pain, either with a more emotional bent or a more physical bent, there are many, many areas of the brain involved, and it will always involve areas of the brain that could be more linked to the, let's say, the physical aspects, but there'll always be parts in the brain in action that are linked to more of the emotional thinking areas. So it's actually a very limiting thing to think of emotional or physical pain. Sure, some human pain states have a lot of physical issue to it. There is damage to structure, damage to tissue, but there's always going to be an emotional component, like fear, like disgust or anger. And even in pain states that are more, let's say, the emotional domain, the pain of losing, the pain of bereavement, the pain of missing out, there'll always be a physical component. Your posture will show it, for example. And if we were to closely explore some of the body chemistry, there would be changes, particularly in the stress area. So I think that's a really important thing to understand about pain, that there will always be a brain involved as well.
A little bit on culture. Many studies report differences in pain thresholds and responses between pain with people in different cultures. For example, the level of radiant heat found to be painful to Mediterranean peoples is merely regarded as warm to Northern Europeans. Your pain will never be the same pain as that experienced by anyone else. David, could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You touch on some really important issues there. And I think there is a chronic pain epidemic in society. And I'd just like to go back a bit and say we're aware that one in four Americans has a pain state that doesn't go away. And it's incredibly expensive. Pain actually costs the United States something like twice what it does to run the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It is a massive problem. And out there are groups who are missing out on effective pain management. You touched on one or two of the groups. One of them is people is the older group. If you go to a nursing home, everybody's full of drugs. There's little education, not enough activity, not enough activities which actually access a fundamental property of the human brain, and that is that we all have our own drug cabinet in the brain. We all have our own pharmacology in the brain, powerful chemicals that we use for pain, which are liberated with education and movement. So the older people are missing out. Children, too, are missing out. It's only the last few years that we've realized that, oh, my gosh, there's also a pain epidemic in children as well. But you certainly pick up the main point there. Everybody's pain is different. Everyone's pain is different to the health professional who manage them, and this needs to be taken into account. There is one other issue I'd like to comment here, and that is particularly in the older groups, that is people who have problems like Parkinson's disease or who have had a stroke or multiple sclerosis or a spinal cord injury. The prevalence of pain in these groups is about 60 or 70%. But, you know, you never hear much about that. And yet here is a group where effective therapies, non-drug or blended with effective drug therapies, could be effective.
When we come back, we'll continue with the best of Paradigm Shifts 2013.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Do you know where your life's path is supposed to take you? What if that path is a frightening one for you to take? How do you stay on course while surviving daily problems while continuing towards your destiny? Listen to A Celebration of Change with host Cherie Rollman. When you reach crossroads in that path, whether career, relationship, or really any life transition, understand how to make the right decisions and how the process can work for you. Tune in to A Celebration of Change every Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to Paradigm Shifts in Wellness and Sport with Dr. Ivan Wergo. To connect with our program today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to Ivan H. at p.